This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
While you're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 123 is something like, how can economics help us to understand and enact our social obligations? And we read The Use of Knowledge in Society by F.A. Hayek from 1945 and On Ethics and Economics by Amartya Sen from 1987. You can join the discussion, get the texts, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, Pareto Optimal in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, maximizing my self-interest in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Alwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Seth Benzel with complete and transitive preferences in Boston, Massachusetts.
Welcome.
So Seth is obviously just a cheap amalgam of Seth Paskin and then Wes's location, Boston. That's what I get out of that so far.
Yes.
So you are an econ guy. Tell us about your background.
I was always interested in kind of social questions. There was a big debate in my high school about whether or not to enact some kind of school social policy, and everyone was really excited about it. Some people really knew that the laptops that they were giving to the kids were a waste of money, and some people really knew that they were a great idea in the future. And I found that conversation really frustrating. So when I got into college, you know, this was also the time of the Great Recession. And so these questions were in the air and I decided to major in economics.
Wait, you're 130 years old?
I am a young person.
Oh, you said the Great Recession, not the Great Depression. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, Great Recession. Yeah. Nomenclature. Yeah. For a while, I thought I wanted to do physics, but then I realized people bouncing off of each other are way more interesting than particles bouncing off of each other. So no offense, Dylan. And just went straight into graduate school since then. So now I study technological change and economies, some fiscal policy stuff, and also do some historical economics.
And as I discovered today, you were a co-author of a paper with Jeffrey Sachs?
Yes, that's right. Robots, curse or blessing. Mark, believe it or not, I actually kind of have you to thank for getting set on this track. We had a forum exchange where you were talking about how as technology develops, why do I have the intuition that there will always be jobs for people to do and you had the opposite intuition? And so this paper is exactly speaking to that question and trying to think about how will the rise of the robots affect wages and income distributions and what are some potential negative knock-on effects. I actually got called a Marxist for this paper in a recent lit review about robots.
Yes. So Seth B. here became apparent to me in the wake of the New Work episode a couple of years ago now, when I was looking for somebody who knew something about economics to tell me why some of the things that seemed like intuitive that you could do to make the world better, why according to economics they wouldn't work, and which led in some ways to a discussion about, is economics something that philosophers should pay attention to, or is it, like many of the social sciences, not something to be ignored, but something that is imbued with a lot of unexamined assumptions and itself needs a good spanking to gain its philosophical footing?
I don't see why those two have to be mutually exclusive.
So, yes. So you suggested these readings or suggested a longer list of readings to other Seth, who has long been advocating an econ episode for us to do. I assumed that we would just do some more Adam Smith, that we would do Wealth of Nations, and I'm sure we'll get around to that eventually. But I think you were one of the folks that said, no, come on, modern economists, that's a historical interest. There are other things that are much more on point.
Yeah, we like to think of ourselves as learning over time. And so it's a modern theory that's developing, and we should talk about what people think today.
So in service of that, we're reading an essay from 1945.
This is actually the exception to the rule. I was told by a professor once, you never have to read anything that's more than 30 years old, except for this essay. It's really, really good. And just as an aside, the American Economic Review, which this was published in, already when this was published in there, this was a highly atypical thing to be published in that journal, which is a top economics journal. there's no math in it, which is would blow people's mind if you opened up the AER today and saw an article with no math.
Maybe we should just sum up the two essays, and then we can move on and just talk about Hayek for the next while.
Sure.
Seth B. was good enough to record a precog for us. We haven't had one of those in a while, so folks can go and just listen to him talking uninterrupted for 10 minutes about these very things to get a more detailed and sensible overview than we're probably going to stumble through right now. The main point of the use of knowledge in society, there were two main points. And the first one, the one that sounds like, yes, common sense, at least to me reading it, was a methodological one, which is, how would you plan an economy? Planning an economy would require that you know everything.
Yeah.
You know what everybody's needs are. You know what the level of supply of everything is. Mm-hmm. And then you could plan the economy. Since we don't have that, it makes more sense to leave it, the planning, to the individuals at the tail end of things who know that this particular population is short on something, that there are weather problems in this part of the world, which is making this kind of crop more rare.
But it's like even more local than that, right? It's not just that there's a shortage in my area. It's that there's a price increase in my area. And how should I react to that myself? I don't even need to know what's happening.
It's that a price increase propagated across the whole system, that my expenses went up or demand went up and I increased prices for customers.
So there you go. You're giving the second point, which is the positive point here. If we say there's something missing, that a central economic planner is not going to have all this information, well, even local economic planners must have some information. They must have somehow, we must have some way of getting them information from hither and yon so that they can make intelligent decisions of what to do locally, whether to produce more, whether to buy now. And the solution is already given in, well, the natural economic order of things, according to Hayek, which is prices.
I will point out that Hayek doesn't claim that this is inevitable or that it's natural. He just claims that it's a solution that we've stumbled upon and we shouldn't be overly cautious about it just because we stumbled upon it.
But it's awesome that if somebody had invented it, we would say, this is the best goddamn thing ever invented.
Prices are magic.
So I want to just back up for just 1 second, because I want to tie together the issue of knowledge that you first brought up, Mark. So what you said was, if you were going to plan an economy, or if you were going to try to manage the economic transactions of, let's say, a large state or a large geography with lots of different types of people and resources and whatever, what Hayek says is that to do that from a central location, to have a single planner or a group of planners that were doing that, they would need all of this information. They would need a lot of knowledge. And it's not practically, even if it's true that all that knowledge exists and is accessible, it's not practically possible to get that to them in a timely fashion where they can do it.
Yeah. And it's some of it, it's unclear how you would even get all of the relevant information, right? So one of the pieces of information you need is, how many tomatoes does my corner Italian restaurant need? And how willing is he to substitute between sliced tomatoes and diced tomatoes? And how much more does my friend prefer this kind of cereal to that kind of cereal to a third kind of cereal? If you actually wanted to try to do this, you'd kind of need a list of everybody's preferences over everything and a list of all of the possible substitutions that all of the factories and all of the shops in your society could make, you know, a little bit more labor and a little bit less tin, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's if you want to give people choice. I mean, the way central planning in a lot of totalitarian states gets around it is they don't give you choice. Your preference for what type of cereal you want doesn't matter. This is the kind of cereal you're going to get.
Yeah. Everyone gets the crusty bread they're willing to wait 3 weeks in line for it.
Right. I want to come back to that point because I think even in totalitarian states, you're going to see black markets immediately emerge to try to get people more of what they want.
Of course. I was being semi-facetious. Let me carry this point. There's an important connection between pricing and knowledge. And what Hayek is saying is that on the flip side of central planning is distributed planning. So that's where individuals transact with one another and they have a small sphere of knowledge, but it's deeper, more specific knowledge about their situation. But they don't know what's going on at the macro level with, like you said, weather patterns in another country that are affecting the supply of wheat or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the gap in their knowledge at the distributed level is made up for by pricing or prices. So prices are a way that It's an order that emerges, so to speak, out of all of these distributed transactions and is a way that information gets translated or moved across people who have overlapping areas of interest and contact. And so what Hayek essentially thinks is there are definitely problems with both approaches, but prices solves the problem for distributed planning, and there is no solution for the problem of centralized planning as far as information flow goes.
I think that nails it, yeah.
And in a way, prices become a sort of symbolic stand-in for
totally
all the things that you don't know. But in your own planning, they give you everything that you need to know. So you don't need to know that there was a bad winter and some crop is in shortage. All you need to know is that the price of tomatoes went up or something like that. And mm-hmm. then you make your decision from there.
So before we get into that more critically, so how does that connect to the second essay, which is actually a whole book? It's three lectures that were adapted for book form given in 1986 to a mixed audience of philosophers and economists. And it also seems to be about economic methodology primarily, and has to do with first and foremost about this assumption that everybody acts selfishly. I can give an introduction to this, but Seth Paskin, I think you had in your notes that you just sent us a way of connecting the two essays that I thought sounded nice.
Well, and I stole it from Seth Benzel's Precog, but essentially, so Hayek puts this thesis forward that there are these two ways to solve this problem, and only the distributed model makes sense, and it only makes sense because we've developed the notion of pricing. But what's not explicitly stated in his essay, but what's a requirement for that to work, is that the economic assumptions about what motivates human behavior in an economic transaction, and then also some higher order assumptions about the way an economy works, have to be in place. And it's those assumptions that Amartya Sen is going to call into question in the second set of essays that we read. But we should probably spend a little time talking about that first, because it's not immediately obvious from Hayek's essay what those things are.
Do you want me to introduce the fundamental welfare theorem?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So Hayek is writing in the 1940s. In the 1950s, you get the development of something called general equilibrium theory. So before then, people had thought about the economy as a whole, but most of the theories that had been developed were of a market. So we talked about the market for corn or wheat, right? But if you really want to talk about all of the interdependencies of everything on everything else, you got to talk about the general equilibrium. And so economists started by thinking about a really abstract universe in which the only way people relate to each other is by this market exchange mechanism, right? So there are no market interdependencies.
Explain that, why those two things are the same. We only relate to each other by exchange. And so what does that have to do with market interdependencies?
Let me give the classic example. So if there's a non-market interdependency, that's called an externality. The classic example of an externality is pollution. So there's the guy who's got the factory. He's selling us Mardi Gras beads. We're buying the Mardi Gras beads from him. Should be win-win-win, right? Except for the fact that the factory is emitting all of this pollution, and it's making all of us sick. And the problem is we can't, nobody owns the air, right? Nobody has an interest to protect the air. So there's kind of a Pareto improvement. We should introduce the concept of a Pareto improvement left on the table, because everyone would be better off if everyone who is breathing the polluted air could bribe the factory owner not to pollute the air. But if they bribed him to do it, just somebody else would come in and do it. So there needs to be some sort of government intervention or some other kind of social coming together to deal with this externality or non-market interdependence.
Okay. I thought you had described it as an interdependence of markets.
No. Yeah, sorry if that was unclear. So market interdependence is great, right? All of the markets are interacting with all the markets. That's the general equilibrium theory. It's when stuff happens outside of markets that a theory of markets can't talk about it.
Okay.
Right.
That's the first big assumption. The second big assumption is that people only care about their own consumption. The only thing that people do in this society is they trade their labor for other people's stuff, and maybe we all trade our labor together to one guy who combines it with a machine he owns and makes something else, and then I get it back. And the idea is that every single one of these exchanges is mutually beneficial at a fixed price. So a third thing that will prevent the fundamental welfare theorem from coming to pass is market power or monopoly. So if you have someone who has a monopoly over something, say shoes, then what they're going to do is they're going to know that by restricting the supply of shoes, they can have a higher price for shoes and get higher profits. It might very well be that the socially optimal result is to produce many more shoes because everybody wants shoes, but you can actually get more profits by restricting the supply of shoes. So that's another way in which the fundamental welfare theorem may fail. But given self-interested behavior, where self-interested is like the really strong kind of self-interest where you only care about your own consumption, given no non-market interdependencies, of which one is externalities like pollution, and given no monopoly, then any market equilibrium will be Pareto efficient. And then given another kind of weaker assumption, any Pareto efficient situation can be maintained as a market equilibrium. Pareto efficiency. So economists like to talk about efficiency. We love efficiency. Why would you want to do something that's inefficient? Right. But when you think about efficiency, usually it's thought of as kind of instrumental, right? What's the most efficient way to produce a pound of corn given a certain amount of inputs? You know, you want to be non-wasteful with inputs. Pareto efficiency takes that a step further. What Pareto efficiency says is that suppose everyone in society is able to rank their outcomes over their futures from the outcome they're most happy with to the outcome they're least happy with. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the case that there's a best one or worst one. There just needs to be a list and they can compare any two options. Then it seems like, at the very least, the best society should be the situation in which you can't make anyone better off without making someone else worse off, right? Because if you could make someone better off without making somebody else worse off, do that, right? Then everybody is better off and there's no downside. So that's the concept of Pareto efficiency. And the fundamental welfare theorem says, given those assumptions, which are really strong and don't hold in the real world, and there's some other stuff that I even mention, you're going to get Pareto efficient outcomes given the market. And that's some of what's going on in the background of Hayek's paper. Now, there are definitely reasons that you might want to have a decentralized market, even if the fundamental welfare theorem doesn't literally hold, none of the assumptions literally hold. There's still going to be pros and cons, and we can talk about interventions in different situations, but that's the theorem.
And it seems like even if you were going to argue that for some particular good, like fire service or education or whatever it is, that you're going to make an exception to this and intervene, then there would still be the underlying assumption that that's sort of parasitic on everything else remaining unregulated. That is the exception, whereas the norm is letting the market do its work.
Yeah. So methodologically, you might think that economists come at this as the assumption is that the market works. And then in any given market, if somebody's advocating for a government intervention, you have to point towards the market failure. Is the market failure an externality like pollution? Is the market failure a monopoly? Mm-hmm. Is the market failure something paternalistic, like people can't make decisions for themselves about how many drugs to do? Is the market failure? And there's the list goes on and on of different situations. Maybe the asymmetric information is another big one. So if some people know more about a situation than other people, they can be exploited by the people who know more. Lots of stuff like that. And then you would say something like, okay, we've identified the market failure. Let's do the minimum amount to fix that and then let the market do everything else. So we didn't get into distribution, but obviously Pareto efficiency also, that's one of the downsides of Pareto efficiency is it doesn't have much to say about distribution.
That is between the rich and poor.
Precisely.
I guess kind of one of the key things that I hear coming out of this, and it will tie into what we're going to talk about with Sen later, is this idea that the fundamental welfare theorem is a shorthand way of talking about how an economic system could be optimized, and optimized specifically around a combination of efficiency, but there is a principle of some kind of, I don't want to say non-interference, but there's a notion that there's an equilibrium that can be reached where everybody is as well off as they can be without their well-being starting to impinge on somebody else.
It's a statement of Adam Smith's invisible hand thing, right? It's the idea that despite the fact that people are self-interested and the market is competitive, what will emerge out of that is an efficient allocation of resources.
But a certain kind of efficiency is all I'm saying. You might say, well, it's efficient to have 10% of the population control all the resources and the other 90% do what they say. There may be an efficiency in that. But in this case, the efficiency is tied to a notion of well-being.
Yeah, so there's two issues. So the first is that for almost any economy you can think of, there's going to be a whole bunch of Pareto efficient outcomes. There are going to be Pareto efficient outcomes where one guy has everything. There's going to be Pareto efficient outcomes where everybody's almost exactly equal, right? So it's weird to talk about it is efficient for this distribution to take place in terms of like consuming the resources of society.
I'm not sure I understood the last part of what you just said.
To make efficiency itself as if it's a definite goal.
Right.
I think there's something intuitively attractive about Pareto efficiency just by the way we put it out there, right? If you accept that what the good society is it's the one that makes everyone as well off as possible, it seems like then the best possible society is at the very least Pareto efficient, and it might be other stuff too.
Okay. Even for pro-market economists, that's not enough. Sen obviously brings up these sorts of criticisms where you could have a Pareto efficient outcome where one person has everything. How do economists typically deal with that fact?
I mean, this wasn't on Hayek's radar, right? At least not that term. That was
Pareto efficiency, I would be hard-pressed to say whether that term existed. People read that essay as prefiguring the fundamental welfare theorem. Maybe I should say a little bit about the other direction of the fundamental welfare theorem. What the other direction says is that any sort of Pareto efficient outcome, and remember we said that at the very least, society should be Pareto efficient. That's kind of like a minimum criteria, or you might think, and then Sen's got stuff to say about that. Once you buy that, then you can say, well, any equilibrium can be supported by a market. So the intuition there is, if you want to help poor people, don't do it by restricting prices. Don't do it by giving handouts in kind, like maybe food stamps. Just give them money, and then they'll do what is optimal for them to do with it. Just redistribute resources.
So don't interfere in the efficiency or in the mechanisms of the market, whatever you do. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, given that you have assumed this really unrealistic, really abstract world, then it doesn't make any sense to help poor people by doing weird stuff like restricting prices or by having government interventions and paying people higher wages. The way you should help poor people is just give them resources, and then they'll do optimal exchanges.
So you could move from one Pareto efficient state to another, right?
Precisely.
You go from one market equilibrium to another, supposing that less inequality were your goal, the second one would be better. Yeah.
Okay. Precisely.
And incidentally, it's named after Vilfredo Pareto, 1848 to 1923. He did use this concept. It was not just named after him. Although I would doubt that he called it Pareto efficiency.
He was humble like that.
So let's take a minute to stop and talk about, it's a St. John's College Graduate Institute.
The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland.
Why, Wes, you've only told us about that about 9 times. Tell us again why St. John's is so great.
It's great for people who like the approach that we take in this podcast, so where you do thoughtful readings of texts and then have serious conversations about that. That's the format for St. John's. So no lectures. Instead, you read a great book, and then you talk about that with other very smart people around the table. And the professors there, we call tutors, direct the conversation, but they don't dominate it. So it's a really unique experience, even compared to other graduate school seminars.
And you just have to have a bachelor's degree in something. So even you, Seth B., could go to St. John's Graduate Institute.
Wow. Hey, Wes. I'm interested in developing a set of rational preferences over all conceivable options I might have. Would going to St. John's help me with that?
I doubt it. The Graduate Institute is currently accepting applications. They're accepted on a rolling basis with no application fee, and as Mark mentioned, a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long science institute programs.
Are we really supposed to still talk about that now?
And they do that every year.
What are
some more? Yale citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in the serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
How intimate is the setting?
I had a tutor there once who threw out her back and started lying in the middle of the table. That's a true story.
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah, there's still a couple other points, I think, about the Hayek paper. Going back to the idea that this is a knowledge problem, it's essentially epistemological. In Hayek's world, knowledge is virtue in the sense of you have essentially perfect knowledge of your own situation.
Yeah, at least the best of anybody.
You have better information about your situation than anybody else does, and you will act in your own best interest to do what's right for you in that circumstance. And one of the things that he points out about this is that that information, that knowledge that you have about your situation is not something that can be put into a statistical or technical or mathematical form. That even though when we look at the aggregate of a bunch of individuals with all this specific knowledge that are doing things in their own best interest, you may see a statistical aggregation come out of that. So you can look at a whole group of people that are doing certain kinds of activity and you say, aha, right? You see that there's a stability that comes out of all of this diverse activity by all these individuals that's based on their own specific knowledge, which is not something that you can codify, does create a certain level of stability that it gets reflected in a statistical measure. Mm-hmm. To think that the fact that the activity can be expressed statistically, it confuses cause and effect if you think that then you can take those statistics and apply it to any given individual. That the information that the individual has simply cannot be represented that way. And this is important for two reasons. One is it's another way that he argues against the possibility of central planning, because what would have to happen is the individual who had knowledge of their situation would have to find a way to actually articulate that in a statistically consumable manner that the central planner could get it in an efficient way and tie it together with other statistical information or mathematically represented information. But it also points to a kind of emergent property of order that comes out of all of this diverse, isolated, self-interested activity, and the disconnect between the individual who's acting and then the aggregate of individuals who are acting is ultimately going to be the difference between talking about how individual economic transactions are regulated between two individuals and talking about groups of people and setting policy. One of, I think, Hayek's points in this paper is to say, because we see order in large groups of people and we start to mathematize that and look at it statistically, we are inclined to think of that as reflective of the cause as opposed to being an effect of that activity. And we are inclined to use that as a reason for making policy decisions and making decisions about how to order, which is another way of getting in the central planning mode. So there's a danger in getting caught up in that emergent order and thinking that that is itself the phenomena as opposed to reflective of something else.
So I think that's exactly right. I would add to your first point about the impracticality of getting this information to the central planner that also individuals will face really perverse incentives to lie to the central planner, too, if you actually try to do this. Central planner is going to say, I've got 1,000 cars. Who needs the cars? It might be the case that everybody says, oh, I really need a car.
That's when Oprah Winfrey is the central planner. You get a car. You get a car.
Yes. The second thing I would say is that Hayek is really talking right there to the macroeconomics of the 1940s, because Keynes is kind of famous for introducing emergent behaviors of the macroeconomy to discuss macroeconomics. Like before Keynes, there was just economics. And then Keynes said, hey, the macroeconomy is doing all this weird stuff that we don't think individuals would do. So let's abstract away from individuals and let's just have this aggregate demand curve and this aggregate supply curve. And so that was a flaw that a lot of economists saw with the macroeconomics of that time. And then later you get what's called the neoclassical revolution in macroeconomics, in which people said, we don't want to talk about aggregate demand. We want to talk about a billion people's individual demands, and then we can all add them all up.
Right. So he calls this the knowledge of the circumstances of time and place. So he says, the sort of knowledge with which I have been concerned is knowledge of the kind which by its nature cannot enter into statistics and therefore cannot be conveyed to any central authority in statistical form. For instance, by lumping together as resources of one kind, items which differ as regards location, quality, and other particulars in a way which may be significant for the specific decision. So what's a good example of the macro versus the time and place thing that to which Hayek refers?
Let's say you have a factory and you can make your output either using tin or brass, right? It doesn't matter which one you use. So you know privately in your head that I can use either 2 units of brass or 1 unit of tin. And then when prices change, if the price of brass goes up high enough, then you switch to tin and vice versa. And we can get even more intricate, more detailed examples than that.
There's nothing I can do with that at a macro level planning wise. What would a central planner even want to do there?
He says right at the beginning of his first paragraph, he has like the only bit of jargon in the entire essay where he says, the efficient outcome is to set marginal rates of substitution equal. And so what that's saying is, so if you were a central planner and you were deciding who should get the brass and who should get the tin, it shouldn't be the case that by trading someone's brass for somebody else's tin, you could get more output. And so one thing that comes out of that, if you assume continuous production functions, and there's some math in the background here, is that every factory, the trade-off between brass and tin should be the same, right? So if brass is 2 times as effective as tin, use it. If brass is 3 times as effective as tin, use it. But if brass is 1.5 times as effective as tin, switch to tin. And so every single factory should obey that same rule. And it turns out that prices tell you what relative quantities to use. So, right, if the price of tin is 2 times as much as brass, then everybody's going to internalize that.
I see.
So we could look at the foolishness of the central planner that says, but everybody should have a right to steel, should have a right to tin. So
I thought you were saying steal as in taking things from other people. That'd be a radical economic plan. Sorry.
Tin for the people.
Tin for the people.
A tin in every pot.
Let them eat tin.
Okay.
The alternative would just be that the central planner says, okay, every factory that makes kitchen fixtures gets 10 units of tin and 10 units of bronze. And then you're going to have some factories that have extra tin and not enough bronze and blah, blah, blah.
I see. Okay.
We're kind of going through the litany of reasons that Hayek thinks that central planning isn't going to work from a kind of logistical and knowledge perspective. But he actually takes it to a sort of higher order, going beyond the practical notion of you can't codify this information, and if you could, you couldn't get it to the central planner in an efficient way and in time and all that. Mm-hmm. And towards the latter part of the essay, he makes a point that if you believe that things cannot evolve that do better work or that do better than we can if we tried to consciously design something, you're mistaken. In fact, and he quotes Whitehead, which I thought was interesting. So this is section 24. Those who clamor for conscious direction and who cannot believe that anything which has evolved without design and even without our understanding of it, he's talking about prices here, should solve problems which we should not be able to solve consciously, should remember this. The problem is precisely how to extend the span of our utilization of resources beyond the span of the control of any one mind, and therefore how to dispense with the need of conscious control and how to provide inducements which will make the individuals do the desirable things without anyone having to tell them what to do. And then he's got a Whitehead quote that follows that, which is nice. But
let me just give you the end of that quote because it's great. Sure. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them.
He's making the point that if you have to consciously deliberate and design things versus just being able to do that, and he uses things, for example, like the notion of variables in mathematics, right, or symbolism, shorthand. We have complex concepts which ultimately become a part of the currency of discourse that allow people to accomplish more and communicate more without having to go through torturous discussions, right?
Yeah, prices are signifiers.
Prices are signifiers. This is totally, I'm going back to what Wes said, and he's absolutely right, that you don't have to understand what sets the price of this particular thing at this point. All of the myriad of factors that go into making that price can be completely hidden from you. The price itself is shorthand for weather and distribution and supply and consumption in other places and a variety of other things that you don't need to worry about. But what I think's interesting about this is that I go back to what I said earlier about him thinking that knowledge is virtue, that your own knowledge of your own situation is your virtue. And that when we talked about Aristotelian virtue ethics, right, there's a component of internalization that we talk about, that you don't follow a rule and you don't do something that's good because of the consequences or the outcomes that you're spying. You do it because it's the right thing to do, and you know it's the right thing to do because you've done it over and over again, or because you have been trained or learned from somebody who's good about how to do these things. And I just want to draw the analogy here that the mechanism that he's talking about, this is a higher order as opposed to an individual structure about how to internalize proper behavior. There's, to me, an echo of that notion in what he's describing here.
It sounds a lot like Wittgenstein to me. For concepts, there's no rule for a use of a concept. The application of concepts is not a central planning, top-down type of thing where we can make explicit rules for it, for instance. Rather, it works in the same sort of way. Meaning is use, let's say. There's a similar thing going on here. Meaning sort of is emergent upon the sum of all these particular behaviors. And I think it's the same thing here with prices, right? The price becomes a sort of signifier or stand-in for a kind of concept, but a very abstract one, right? Which obscures lots and lots of different kinds of content, like you said, like weather and any other factor that affects prices. So it's different in that sense. But you were relating that to Aristotle, and that's very interesting because Sen, I think, has some ties into virtue ethics as well. But what were you saying exactly? The idea of a virtue being a behavior. So for instance, you can't just take a Kantian maxim, which again might be the central planning analogy, and reason it out and say, okay, I'm never going to lie because of, you know, blah, blah, blah. Rather, it's a...
You should only lie if it's expensive.
Yeah, I mean maybe Aristotle's far more context sensitive in a way.
What I was doing there was, is I was focusing on that part in section 24 where he says, how to dispense with the need of conscious control, right? The problem is, how do we allow things to function without the control of any one person? What do we need for that? And he's like, well, one of the things that we need is we need a system that induces people to do the right thing without them being told what to do. Mm-hmm. So I just read that as saying, when you're talking about making the analogy to Aristotle, so Aristotle, virtue is taught, it's learned. You study
habituation.
I use the word learning, but you're right. It's habituation. And he's essentially saying that the market, and specifically the way prices function in the market, habituates people in such a way that then they can really effectively use resources without anybody telling them exactly what to do. No, they don't have to say, somebody says, go buy this, go build this, go do that. There's this really, really, really simple shorthand symbolic thing called a price. And the price induces people to do the things that we want them to do, namely to create and build and consume and whatever else, without actually having to tell them, build, consume. You just see prices move, and that makes you either want to buy something because it got cheaper, or it makes you want to build it because it's expensive and you can make money selling it. And so it's an interesting habituation. It's the same mechanism.
That is a really interesting connection.
It tells you where all the mutually beneficial exchanges are. If you didn't have prices, you wouldn't be able to know what can I do that helps me and helps someone else. That's what prices do.
So if someone else is making a killing from creating a load of crap, then it encourages you to likewise create the same kind of load of crap to try to tap into that same market, which then by maybe spreading the crap around...
It's not crap if people want it, Mark.
Thank you, Wes.
Lower the price of the crap.
So, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, if you're going to call it crap, then you have to appeal to a market failure in which either there's asymmetric information and people don't know what they're buying, or there is a monopoly and the guy can sell it for way more than it's worth, or there is, it calls for paternalism because people aren't internalizing their own good. They think it's good, but they're wrong. We know better than them.
All of which we practice on a regular basis here on The Partially Examined Life.
So concrete examples being fast food, for instance.
So yeah, exactly. So
which we don't see as overpriced crap, but is very plentiful crap.
Or like this, you look at the Bloomberg soda ban, right? So Bloomberg said, okay, this is enough. People can't handle the decision of buying big sodas. I'm going to ban the purchase of big sodas.
And then the big soda black market got going.
And then you get, yeah. Well, so A, yes, right? People find ways to game the system, but it's just inconvenient enough for some people to not game the system. And in that case, the only way you can justify that, at least in the Pareto world where there's unidimensional, in utilitarianism world, the only way you can justify that is I know better than the consumer what's good for him.
But it's not just that, because isn't there a pollution analogy here? Isn't the health of the populace?
Sure. I mean, so that's a very good point. suppose we started off in exactly the idealized market and the only issue was people drink two big sodas. We would anticipate that they would internalize the future cost of their bad health on themselves, right? When you decide whether or not to buy a soda, you should think about the health consequences in addition to the deliciousness consequences, in addition to the price consequences, right? But once society has decided we're going to set up a system by which we're going to pay for everybody's health care, well, then, yeah, maybe we do have an interest in making sure you don't free ride off of that and get unhealthier than you would have otherwise had you been paying for it.
So the idea there is just that your unhealthiness actually has a ripple effect and harms others and can be regulated because of that.
Yeah. And so, of course, you can appeal to irrationality here. You can say something like, is it Socrates or Aristotle that talks about the objects in the mirror are farther away than they appear, right? So it might be that people behave as though there's an optical illusion and getting diabetes 20 years from now, like I can't internalize that information. It's too abstract to me. So that'd be a way that you can get to paternalism.
I mean, obviously people are enormously self-destructive and they're not always behaving in their self-interest. I mean, to prefigure Sen's criticisms. I can't believe Sen was the first person to notice that. So
people understand this. And so Sen talks a little bit about the choice interpretation or the agency interpretation of action as opposed to the utility or the welfare theory of action. So you might just say, well, people don't choose what's good for them. People choose what they choose, right? And so maybe you want to maximize utility just because you're maximizing someone's agency. And then Sen's going to talk about the divergence between the agency value and then the welfare value. But yeah, no, it's an old idea that people do self-destructive stuff. I may be overselling the case that people act in their own self-interest, but then you have to take the opposite approach, right? How do we talk about when society should tell someone that they're doing something badly? You know, if society has decided that being gay is bad for you, should society come right in and impose that, right? That's the kind of argument.
Mm. Right.
At the very end of the essay, before he summarizes, he says the following. The price system is this thing that just formed and it made society possible in some respect, or at least the civilization that we know and understand is made possible by the pricing system. And he says, look, if you're going to design an alternative, you have to take into account the notion that this civilization that emerged that was based on prices, it's not just about the efficient allocation of resources. It's made it possible to a very large extent for individuals to choose what they want to pursue and freely use their own knowledge and skill. Now, this is a callback to his other essay called The Road to Serfdom, which he basically says...
Or his book, right?
Book, yeah, sorry. It's essentially the thesis of that. It's something like central planning or putting more power in the hands of government to make decisions about how to order economic life ultimately leads to the ordering of social life and political life and moral life and totalitarianism. And so there's an implicit and a much stronger claim here, which is that this economic ordering is better. It has a normative value to it because it promotes freedom, freedom for individuals to choose how to be fulfilled and how to satisfy their own well-being. Now, I think that's debatable for several reasons, but it's important that that's a key tenet because I think that is something that we see echoed in today's modern politics, at least in the Anglo world, where you see people who claim to be conservatives or have a conservative economic or a free market position saying that the free market position is not just free for the market, but it's the only way to guarantee freedoms for individuals. And so you'll see them fall back and use that as a backstop. It's actually a conversation killer in a lot of respects, but it's here.
Yeah, what I would say to that is you can think about, and Sen talks about this, is you can talk about freedom in two ways. You can talk about instrumental freedom. Do you give people freedom in order that they can make choices that are good for themselves? And then you can make the argument that freedom is good because it's good, right? So that's kind of the tack that Nozick takes, that freedom is the one thing you can't violate. Everyone should get freedom, right? And then this is kind of a utilitarian. I think Hayek sees them exactly in line and maybe Sen sees them a little bit in conflict. But you can imagine another argument for freedom, which is just it lets people choose what's good for them.
Well, the other argument he makes at the end of this is that If you want to say that something is better than the market, you need to find a solution which is, quote unquote, produced by the interactions of people, each of whom possess only partial knowledge. And then he goes on to say, there is something fundamentally wrong with an approach which habitually disregards an essential part of the phenomena with which we have to deal, the unavoidable imperfection of man's knowledge, and the consequent need for a process by which knowledge is constantly communicated and acquired. It's a very Socratic kind of economic approach where you acknowledge our fallibility and our epistemological fallenness, the fact that we can't be omniscient, or our ignorance, to put it in Socratic terms. And because of that, we have to rely on this system with its own sort of emergence rather than trying to control it or trying to pretend that we have that God's eye point of view.
Yeah, and it doesn't just hold for knowledge either. It also holds for skills and abilities.
Right, yeah.
So now we have phones that keep our calendar for us. They do a lot of our memory for us.
And so people need to say something like, how costly is it to me to keep track of my calendar myself in terms of hours, in terms of stress? Then they look at the price of the calendar phone option on the market. And then if it's below the cost, they buy it. If it's higher, then they keep doing the calendar stuff themselves.
But no one ever really does that. I want that shiny thing.
That's right.
And then you rationalize it. Oh, it's going to be useful. It's going to make me more productive. And as they text away to, yeah.
Does that mental pleasure of acquiring shiny thing, right? Are we going to count that as good? I don't see any reason that shouldn't count as good.
Yeah. This idea that what the system does is create a way for individuals to freely choose their pursuits. The counterexample is Wes is marketed to by Apple and he sees all of his peers getting iPhones and he can't stand. He just gets overwhelmed by the marketing blush and by the social peer pressure. And he can't rationally have that deliberation to pick the iPhone. He's just got to have one. And it's not a rational decision anymore. And he has no freedom in that choice. And the same thing where sugar is addictive. So those people who say, I want my 64-ounce big gulp. And you're like, you are addicted. That is a drug and you are addicted. That's another type of thing that our wonderful free market system has permitted.
This gets at whether the old Platonic question of whether you're going to identify the good with pleasure, right? And, as Sen points out, we don't have to think of utility simply as maximizing what people want, right? It could be that the good is defined objectively outside of some people's subjective preferences. So it is a complicated question because on the one hand, we're afraid of the nanny state dictating whether your iPhones are good for you and whether you should have them. But on the other hand, we're highly unaware of what's good for us. And the many times things are both good and bad. Yes, the iPhone is pleasurable. That's good in some sense. And yes, it's useful in some ways, but then even usefulness at a certain point can get perverted and inverted into something that's just merely addiction, right? So it's useful for me to be able to communicate with people in this way. But then I find myself glued to my phone, texting people constantly, and it becomes a time waster. Where is the point between productivity enhancer and time waster? It's often not very clear. So these issues are actually quite murky. And the idea that there are simple consumer decisions, I don't even think that's true.
The idea is that these things would be learned over time, that yes, a lot of individual consumers make foolish choices regarding cigarettes, for instance, but then over time, as the truth of the health effects of cigarettes.
It took a lot of nanny state intervention to bring down. It took a lot of educational campaigns. It took a lot of taxes on cigarettes. It took a lot of non-market forces to do that.
Yeah, sure. I'll make one observation on Seth's example of the iPhones, right? So even there, it's unclear whether there's irrationality happening there. There's definitely a market failure, right? So Mark sees everyone getting iPhones and he says, oh man, I can't resist the urge to get an iPhone, right? Is what's happening there that he's just not self-interested, right? He's got this keeping up with the Joneses utility function, which is, not self-interested, but Sen later breaks self-interested into different parts, right? It's not a utility function that only depends on your consumption, but it is self-interested, right? And you might make the rational decision, I will have the mental unpleasure of not keeping up with the Joneses if I don't buy the iPhone, and therefore I am making this rational decision to buy one. And it would definitely be a market failure because there's a non-market relationship. You're getting the externality of envy, but it might still be rational.
Oh, envy is an externality. Huh.
Right, yeah. So if you have any feelings about something else somebody's doing, that's a non-market interaction.
Huh. That's hilarious. I find that amazing.
So my point, Seth B., was just simply that if markets worked the way that this welfare model wants them to work, which is symmetric, transparent information between parties, then there would be no such thing as marketing. Companies would be, this is our product. These are the benefits of this product. This is how much the product costs. This is what our competitors do. This is why our products are better than our competitors, right? And then you go, huh, are those claims true? Why, yes, they are. I see that it is in my rational self-interest to purchase this product from you than from somebody else. But instead, what you get is a 30-second commercial showing a hand holding a device with some sort of like ding, 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 ding music in the background. And at the end, you just see a logo that looks like a black outline of an apple with a bite taken out of it. And suddenly you must have one. I'm just saying that's not what I think Hayek was thinking.
That would be a market failure.
Except that that's the way they're designed to work. That's exactly how, what is marketing? It's called marketing, right? I mean, it's part of the system, isn't it?
It's a problem with the fundamental welfare theorem amongst the fundamental welfare theorem's many, many problems is that it can't account for the existence of marketing.
Okay. My professional career has been outside of the realm of the fundamental welfare theorem, so that's good to know.
There you go. But I still think economics is cool, even if you don't believe the fundamental welfare theorem. So let's not give up right now.
All right. So let's, why don't we move on to Amartya Sen.
All right. That's all you get right now. Come back for part two next week or become a Partially Examined Life citizen and get the entire thing ad-free right now. Also, September 25th to 26th, we're going to be in Pittsburgh attending a conference doing a show on Hannah Arendt. So look at partiallyexaminedlife.com for details about both of those things. See you later.